Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
The publication of this lecture, Secrets to a Happier Marriage, was made possible through a generous grant given for the merit and honor of a true Eishes Chayil, Miriam Bas Mordechai, Mrs. Miriam Niederlander, and her parents, Ephraim Ben David Ubasya Bas Shmuel, Fred and Betty Niederlander, and Shoshana Bas Yehoshua, Mrs. Rose Tweetu, and Mordechai Ben Nissim Olav Sholem, Mr. Mordechai Tweetu of blessed memory.
In all of Jewish life, there's no event that compares to the pageantry, festivity, and outpouring of emotion like that of a chasana, of a Jewish wedding. All those privileged to attend this event could well attest to the sense of grandeur and import that is palpable throughout. According to the Kabbalah, the Jewish mystic tradition, even the deceased Bobbies and Zadies, the grandparents of the Chos and the Kala, the young couple, come out of their place in Gan Eden, in heaven, to Shep Nachas, and to attend the ceremony. In a sense, a Jewish wedding is a coronation, the bride and the groom being the royal couple. Throughout the wedding and the week following, the young couple are truly treated like a king and queen. The details of a chasana, a wedding ceremony, are richly detailed in many scholarly texts. What is less detailed is the secret of maintaining that sense of happiness and grandeur throughout one's lifetime. Historically, a Jewish marriage was viewed as a bastion of tranquility in a sea of the dissatisfaction, turbulence, and strife of the outside world. Unfortunately, with the dual modern plagues of the widespread ignorance of the Torah, coupled with the all-pervasive influence of a morally bankrupt society at large, today's Jewish marriage faces unprecedented challenges. How to help meet those challenges with the knowledge of the spiritual and psychological dynamics of a fulfilled marriage is the topic of tonight's lecture. I hope all of you have the handout. And we've arranged this lecture into 8 separate sections. The first letter of each section spelling the word marriage. The M stands for mystic, and it denotes the divinely ordained or mystic relationship that a husband and a wife have. The initial meeting of a man and a woman who eventually become a man and wife is often described in modern literature as a chance meeting or as a serendipitous accident. In truth, the Talmud views a marriage as being divinely ordained, with a mystic hand of providence involved from the very beginning. The passage of the Talmud that we quote in the first paragraph claims in sense that marriages are truly made in heaven. In the last half of the first paragraph, we quote, Rav said in the name of Reuven ben Istrabuli, from all places of holy writ, the Torah, the prophets, the holy writings, it may be shown that a woman is destined to a man by God. And it goes on to quote the various sources. The form that it takes. There's really two distinct forms. One is the form described early on in that first paragraph. That as soon as the embryo is formed, 40 days before the formation, the earliest formation of the fetus, approximately 6 weeks, at that initial stage, a person's life is mapped out for him or her. There's a statement from the Talmud, Tractate Nida, that as the baby is being formed, decisions are made in heaven what kind of life that child, adult, is going to lead. He or she is going to be poor or rich, wise or not wise, strong or weak. The whole spectrum of one's life is mapped out, save for one area. It is not decreed whether the person should be a saintly person or a non-saintly person. How one spiritually develops is in one's own province. The passage that's quoted here deals with another area of one's life. Not as only one's individual path mapped out, but one's partner is also there in the plan. Who the person is going to marry has been predicted, has been set, as we say, it's bashert. It would follow that if a man meets what he considers his ideal mate, in Yiddish, the richtige shidduch, there's a sense that you've known the person your whole life. That's part of this process. What determines why one man should marry that woman and not another woman is partially based on a concept that we went over last week, and I'd like to briefly discuss this because it has so many ramifications. One of the basic tenets of the Kabbalah, of the Jewish mystic tradition, is the idea of reincarnation. That we may not necessarily have been here for the first time. Our essence is spiritual. We occupy our bodies. This is nach 120, after 120 years, when our time comes. Our consciousness leaves the body, goes to another plane. Very often, we are to be reborn again. And the path that our new life takes is based on the kind of decisions we made in a previous lifetime or lifetimes. And all of that goes into the determining factors of what kind of mate we will have. Last week, we quoted briefly from the works of Brian Weiss, Many Lives, Many Masters. He and a number of other researchers have found an interesting phenomenon. It's only in its initial stages. Much more research has to be done by serious researchers. But quite often, people under hypnosis recall richly the details of past lives. And very often, and this is a theme that comes again and again in through the individual research and through the cumulative research, that the people that we end up being the children of or spouses of, parents of, are people that we've related to in a previous lifetime. And many of the issues that have to be dealt with one's spouse or parent or whatever, are issues that are vital, to one's spiritual growth, there are issues that have cropped up before. So therefore, the choice of why this man is attracted to this woman and ends up marrying her, it's quite often based on a history that's unknown to the person. The ramification, though, is tremendous. From a spiritual point of view, as we stress the mystic element, we are here to improve ourselves, to improve the world about us. We've been here before, perhaps, or not on this earth, on a different plane. We're going to leave, and we're going to ultimately be judged as to the extent that we've made a change, a positive change in our lives. There's a famous statement from the Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna, the famed Gaon of Vilna, who lived some 200 years ago, that the purpose of life on earth is character reformation. That's what we're here for, to change our character, to improve, to become more sensitive, more giving, more disciplined, more spiritual. We have to make changes. And if we don't, we just float through life. His statement was, that what's the purpose of living? I mean, you're given this tremendous opportunity. You should do something with it. Marriage is part of that opportunity, which we'll go into much greater detail. That's one area of what we say is bashert, the shidduch, the two partners, in a sense, were meant for each other. This was determined before they were born. There's another factor, though. Not always do we get the basherta. Not always do we get the one who was planned for us way before we were born. And that's for two reasons. One is, a person goes through a life, marries the right one. Somehow the marriage dissolves through death or divorce. The person remarries. That second shidduch, that second match, the second marriage, is called zivug sheni, the second pair. And that, the Talmud states, takes tremendous ingenuity on God's part. It's like putting a square peg into a circular hole. It doesn't necessarily fit. It's described, the zivug sheni, the second, as kosher kekriyas yamsuf. It's a marriage which is difficult as the parting of the Red Sea. It's a miracle. The Medrash, the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, describes the coming together of the man and the wife that are not really totally suited for each other, as an exercise of God's imposing his will on this couple, and by blind attraction or what other forces are involved, they look aside to those areas that make them incompatible, only focus on those areas of compatibility, and voila, the shidduch is made. It takes a lot of divine intervention. Whereas the zivug rishon, the first one, was what we call a piece of cake. It was all design. They just fit into together like pieces of a puzzle. The second one is not so easy. Many of the Talmudic commentaries have a different explanation, additional explanation of what is known as, we call, the zivug sheni, the second marriage, so to speak, the second mating. And they explain as follows. Originally, when a person is born, we said, this one is meant for that one. Before they meet, though, they may have undergone tremendous changes in their lives. In other words, if nothing had happened, you take these two little kids, you raise them in isolation, so to speak, they're a perfect pair. But each one of them has gone through different experiences, different tests through life, been exposed to different traumatic situations. Sometimes one of them outgrows the other, even before they meet. And there's a situation at times that God will intervene and give someone a different shidduch, a different mate than what was originally intended. Again, let's say the scenario was that this particular boy should marry this particular girl. He is advanced far beyond her, or she's advanced far beyond him. At this point, it's not fair. There may be a resonance of personalities there, but because of so many different factors, either she would pull him down, he would pull her down, and sometimes there's a change. And that change is called Zivug Sheni, the second. The Me'iri, one of the great medieval commentators, adds, though, to effect a change, let's say you're worthy of something better. You really want God to intervene, because as nature will take its course, you will naturally marry the one that you will, that was meant for you to naturally be attracted to. In order for God to intervene, you have to pray. You may be worthy, but you want God to change the course of nature, you have to pray. And through prayer, it's possible to change. This is how the Me'iri explains. There's a precedent for this, by the way. The Talmud, again, there's another passage in the Tractate Nida, page 70, that Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania, one of the great early sages of the Mishnah, came to Alexandria. The sages of Alexandria came to him and asked him several questions. One of those questions was, what is a person to do to become wise? And as the commentaries explain, that this is a person who is not born with tremendous intellectual capacity. So he answered, says, he should learn with great diligence. And they replied, many have tried, didn't succeed. He added then, well, he should pray to the one who's the source of all intelligence. Pray to God. He says, then why didn't you tell us to begin with pray? He says, no, prayer by itself doesn't help. You have to help it along. Another question they asked was, what is a person to do to become wealthy? And again, the commentaries explain, this is a person who is destined originally not to be a wealthy person. He wants to change his mazel, the course of his life. By the way, when we wish somebody mazel tov, what we're doing is we're really giving that prayer. We are wishing that if the mazel, what would have been normally the course of that person's life, had not been good, we pray, our wish, our blessing is, mazel tov, may it be good. This is really, basically every time you wish mazel tov, it's a prayer. In fact, let me tell you a little story. I was just this Shabbos, I was in Lakewood, New Jersey. And my son had a little baby girl. That's what I was waiting for. And there was a story told over. Not everybody, when a girl is born, makes a kiddush. I mean, different customs, different families. In our family, we make a kiddush. And the story was told about a girl who was in her high 20s, early 30s, who had not found the right shidduch, not the right zivug, didn't find the right person. And the father complained to one of the great rabbis in Israel, what should he do? They've tried this, they've tried that, they've gone to all the shadchanim, you know, all the matchmakers, they try to pull all the strings. Sinishka Gangan, like, no, it didn't work. So he asked him, did you make a kiddush when your daughter was born? And he said, no, I guess that wasn't the custom of their family. He says, you know, one of the important factors when you make a kiddush and everyone comes is everyone wishes you mazel tov. You get a blessing from everyone. Everyone is giving you their prayers. He says, you know, your daughter missed that. So as the story goes, and his daughter was in her 20s or 30s, he made a kiddush in shul, I don't know, invited the whole place. And, you know, it seemed a little strange. He's making a kiddush a little, you know, maybe he was a late person, you know. But he made the kiddush, and soon after, as the story goes, she became a kallah, she became engaged. But when we wish mazel tov, what we're doing is we are offering our prayers that just in case the course of life wouldn't be, the challenges would be severe, our blessing is, our prayer is, it should change. The people of Alexandria, one of their questions was, what happens if it's hard to make a living? What should one do? Their answer was, you should act in business with great honesty, with great integrity. And again, their question was, but many have tried this and it didn't work. Again, he replied, well, one should pray to He who is the source of all wealth. So they said, so you should have told us from the beginning. He says, no, but prayer without being in business honestly also doesn't work. You have to do yours, God will do His. But there is a role of prayer. Similarly, a person can't pray that I want something better, than would have been, Bashert. In other words, I want something better. You have to put yours in, and this goes beyond the looking or putting feelers in the community and trying to meet people. It goes with the idea of trying to change yourself. To the extent you become a better person, there's more reason for God to intervene in your life. So let me just make a synopsis of what we've come here with the M, with mystic. A shidduch, as we said, is bashert. God's involved in marriages. And the two people are involved in an odyssey through life of growth. And that's why they were meant for each other. Just as we say, life is growth and change in a positive sense, the husband and the wife were put together so they should grow together. And very often, as one grows through life, perhaps God will intervene with prayer and with one to give one the suitable mate at a higher level of performance, so to speak, of the changing, the reforming process. So the first thing is mystic. The A of marriage is affection. And here we'll read together just the beginning of the source. This is taken from the Tractate Yevamos. Our rabbis taught, he says, concerning a man who loves his wife as himself, who honors her more than himself, it goes on, says, thou shalt know that thy tent is in peace. And the Rambam, in his magnum opus, the Jewish law, the Yad HaChazaka, quotes this as a requirement, a legal requirement of a husband to a wife. I'd like to go into this. First of all is the issue of love. The term love, and it's a term really that goes through all languages, is a very confusing one. And I think part of our problems is this semantic tension. We love our parents. We love our children. That's one form of love. It's a love of giving, of sharing, very strong emotions. We also perhaps love vanilla ice cream. We love fried chicken or pizza. We also call that love. Really what it is more of a craving. You love the experience. You don't love chicken, then why did you eat it? You know, you don't eat your parents, right? So why do you eat chicken? Because you really don't love chicken. We call it love. We love, or we like the experience of the eating of the chicken. When we go into the idea of a marriage and we say that one partner loves the other, or before they actually married and they meet, it's very hard to know when one articulates that sentence what that means. Is it a in a sense of a spiritual love, and a love of giving, of caring, of sharing? There are scholars who maintain that the Hebrew word ahava, love, is related to the Aramaic word hav, which means give. The idea of loving is sharing, is bonding, is merging. That's what really true love is. But when you say you love, do you mean that? Or do you mean, I feel so good when I'm around this person? It's very self-centered. It's like you feel good when you experience a certain form of entertainment, like a play or an orchestra. So, is it you love being around the person? Or is that sense of love of you feel as one? The problem is, and really this is part of our semantics, is it's very confusing. What's meant here in this passage of the Talmud, the one loves his wife as himself, is referring to this love of sharing. In fact, one could perhaps say that the love here that we're dealing with is perhaps even more profound, I mean it's definitely more profound, than the love that's required for our fellow human being. There's a mitzvah in the Torah, one of the 613 mitzvos, is Vohafta l'rayacha kamoha. You should love your, let's translate, your neighbor, your fellow, as yourself. The usage of the Hebrew is Vohafta l'rayacha. The prefix li is two or four. In this passage, ho'oyev es ishto, the prefix is the word es, and there's a difference. The word es refers to the object. It's a direct object. Li means on behalf of, for. One of the great biblical commentaries of last century, the Malbim, explains that the mitzvah of loving one's neighbor does not refer to the emotion of love, but refers to the idea of caring for. Now that's why it says li, v'yohafta li reyacha. You should care for your neighbors yourself. Because we can't demand that deep love for your neighbor as yourself. That emotion is beyond normative expectations. But when it comes to a spouse, we say ve'yohaf, says ohoyev es ishta, one loves one's wife. Here it's the object. It's not just caring for. It's that direct feeling as one loves a parent, one loves a child. The second part here is mechabdo yosem megufo. One honors, one takes care of her more than his body. And here, the second part deals with caring. And the responsibility of a husband to a wife is that one sacrifices for a wife. I mean, this is what shall know that the tent is in peace. If you need a new suit, your wife needs a new suit or dress or whatever. She comes first. That's Chabda Yosem Megufo. That's a question. I don't want to go into like the, you know, the nitty gritty over here. But there is the idea of, it isn't just sharing, it's caring. There's a tremendous passage in the Tractate Chulin. Again, where it deals with the relationship of a husband and a wife, and about the importance of taking care of a wife more than one takes care of oneself. And it makes the statement, your responsibility is to take care of your children, your wife, at your own cost. For your own care, says, at that point, let God take care of you. And as when it comes to, you know, there's a finite resources here. Your wife comes first. That sense, that feeling of security that's created, is what the Talmud refers to, should know, says, that thy tent is in peace. So here we have, again, the A as affection, and the affection on two levels. One is love. And again, the love is not the love of I love the experience. It's I love the person. And as we said before, it ties in with the M of mystic, because we are really one. We're meant for each other. We are one. One loves his own body. One loves his wife. It's the same. It's one. The second is the idea of mechabda, of honoring, taking care of her needs. And that is that the husband takes his wife's needs before his own needs. That's the A. R is resources. One of the major causes of the strain of marriage is the lack of funds. It creates a lot of dissonance in the house, a lot of frustration. The Talmud phrased it here is on top of page 3 of the notes. One should always take heed that there be corn. Corn is an English translation, which means grain, in his house. For strife is prevalent in a house only on account of food. There's lack. There's a sense of insecurity. And really what it's saying here, the message it's saying, and really it's really a message which is made toward to the husband. Part of the marriage contract, the kesubah, is the husband's requirement to support his wife. It has to be taken seriously. There are situations where they both decided to sacrifice for a higher goal. You're familiar with the situation. The wife works and the husband goes to medical school and perhaps specializes. It's a sacrifice on both. It's a joint decision that she's decided to give up her what she's entitled to for a higher goal. You find this very often. Those who are studying to be rabbis. Also, that they're living under severe financial strain. The wife is forced to work, but it's a decision she made because, again, they're working for a higher goal. But it can't be taken for granted. I mean, ultimately, the husband's requirement is to take care of his wife. And when he doesn't, it's a source of tremendous ills in a marriage. The R is for relations. Traditionally, with the exception of certain cultures that have been studied widely, I mean, in great depth by anthropologists, but the vast majority of cultures throughout the world, have it that the husband in the relationship of a husband-wife, and again, there are really two parts, as we said, and one part, and we're going to get to the really what comes into the I. Let's just go down from the R to the I for a moment. Individuality. Where we quote the again a passage from the Talmud Yevamos, Kol Odom Shein Lo Isha Ein Odom. A man without a wife is not a man. The definition of a man are two parts. And as we said before about the mystic element, in terms of the spiritual level, they're two parts of one whole. On one hand, the husband and the wife look at themselves as a unit. There's a beautiful story that's told over from Reb Arya Levin. Reb Arya Levin was one of the great saints who lived in Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. He died in 1969. And the story is told that he came to a doctor and his wife hurt her leg. And he spoke to the doctor. They both came in, you know, to see the doctor. And he began, says, "Doctor, our leg is hurting us." It wasn't just her leg, it's our leg. Because we're really two parts of one whole. So on one hand, it's important to view the marriage as really, it's a completion of the spiritual oneness of a person. I'd just like, again, to maybe add another dimension to this. And it fits in with the idea of affection as well, and the idea of love. If, from the traditional Jewish standpoint, if one looks at themselves as a spiritual being that's lived before they were born in another plane, that will live after they die, and they're merely occupying their body, if one really truly believes this, is convinced this is true, it follows, therefore, that one's looks at himself as really as a soul that is operating in a body. But you are first and foremost a soul, a spiritual entity. That's what you are. Your body is like clothing. That changes the way you look at yourself. It changes the way you look at everyone around you, your employees, your employers, your clients, your colleagues. They're not just educated, advanced apes, but rather are angels, right, in human clothing. Likewise, when one looks at one's spouse, you're not just looking at the bone and the skin, the hair. That's just like clothing. The essence of who you're married to is a spiritual entity. If one looks at one's spouse, both sides, and the externals have a different role. If one looks at themselves as I am my body, that's what I am, is I'm my body. As you look at somebody else's outer whatever they are, says in a different, totally different light than you look at themselves. No, I'm dealing with someone who's a soul, who's a spirit. And that's just clothing. It comes and it goes. A major problem, is as we grow older and we look around, and if we define love as merely not the idea of sharing and the feeling of being one, but rather love is like you love fried chicken, you find, you have perhaps a greater thrill with somebody else afterwards. That's how you define your love. Someone is more attractive, more humorous. If love is the idea of two kindred souls that share their lives together, you look at yourself. It's not looking at somebody else, like you're going to a movie or a play. You're looking at yourself. It's just two parts of one body. And really those two parts of one body are just merely the extremities. of the essence of the person. It's two souls. So your view is totally different. And how you view what your function of marriage is totally different. I'd like to now go back now to our relations. Traditionally, stated before, in almost all cultures, with the exception of a few, in the marriage, the husband is the dominant partner. There are two parts. There are two souls, as we said. I mean, it's not that there's two people. It's not an employer and an employee. It's really two parts. It would be akin to the husband being the head and the wife being the heart. They're both vital organs. Both add to each other. But there's a specific area that the husband has, a specific area the wife has. I know in business partnerships, one of the most difficult things is having a partner that does the same thing you do. It creates a lot of tension. It's very hard to live as equals. I mean, there's a great experimentation now. The form that marriage is taking today is very different than the traditional form. We have yet to see the statistics if ultimately the newer form is a better form. One of the major reasons why the newer form was adopted because of the abuses of the older form. Because after all, if you don't have the traditional Jewish viewpoint that a marriage is a spiritual bond and both couples are growing together spiritually, challenging each other and growing together spiritually, you don't have that saving grace. So all you have are just two people living together. One who calls themselves the boss, and the other who has tremendous expectations of the other. The other who doesn't see that the other has earned that exalted position in the family. Creates an awful lot of tension. I mean, that's why it's become so prevalent to opt to a different form of marriage, where you have two equal partners. But again, traditionally, and according to the Talmud, really, that's, I guess, emotionally, and how they were designed, what they're best suited for, is that the position of the husband is the head, the position of the wife is the heart. And according to the Talmud, it goes against one's nature to have a reversal of roles. This is we quote it here for effect. About three people whose lives are not lives, who lead terrible lives. One of them is the person whose wife rules over him, feels unnatural. I'd like to tell you a beautiful story here. It's a joke, but it's great. The story is that somebody died, came to heaven, and there were two desks where the souls were being processed, being interrogated and processed. One line in front of one of the desks was so long, this newly dead soul, person who came in, couldn't see the end. Like it was just, like this is a long with the Yiddish Golus. You know, it was just, it went without end. The other desk was just one person standing waiting to be processed. And the new soul just didn't say, what are these two lines? So he asked his angel guide, he says, what's the meaning of the two lines? So he says, you see that long line? Those are all the husbands that have been dominated by their wives. And that line over there, that's the ones who've dominated, the husbands who've dominated their wives. So this is, he's got to see the guy, you know. He's got to see this one who's taken charge of his life. And he goes over, sees this scrawny, puny little guy, this Nebuch. And then he's getting his doubts here. Like, what is this guy doing in this line? And he goes over to him and, excuse me, I don't want to offend you. Can you tell me, what are you doing in this line? So the guy said, frankly, I don't know. My wife told me to stand here. We started with, let's just review what we have so far. We started with M, which is the mystic relation, the spiritual relationship, which is really, which is divinely ordained between a husband and a wife. The A was the affection, the responsibility of feeling of oneness. The R, the first R, is resources and the importance, and this is really the onus is on the husband, to provide for the family. The second R is relations that each one of the members of the household have a different role. The I is individuality, that the individuality of a person merges with his spouse and becomes one. The A now is attention. As we said before, the metaphor, the husband the head and the wife the heart. The men and women, and there are many studies, it's a fact that's assumed by the Talmud. There's a recent bestseller, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, which point out the differences, the emotional differences between a husband and a wife.
Yes.
And very often men take for granted, are not sensitive to the feelings of their wives. And this is the passage that we quote here. This is taken from the tractate in the Talmud Bava Metzia, 59a. And Rav said one should always be heedful of wronging his wife, for since her tears are frequent, she is quickly hurt. A man and a wife, a woman, deal on different frequencies. And it's very important, and this is really very often what the function of counseling is, for them to understand that they are not just you just didn't marry another guy or another girl. You know, it's different, and you work on different frequencies. A woman is normally much more expressive, much more sensitive. So one area of attention is the sensitivity that the partners have to have. Because husbands and wives don't naturally think on the same frequency. There's another area, which is an important area. And I like to begin this with a little story which is mentioned in the Talmud, in a work parallel to the Talmud. There's a famous story in the Torah about Korach. Korach is the one who began this whole rebellion against Moses, against Moshe. And the rebellion actually began with Korach's wife. Because Korach's wife, she loved her husband dearly, felt that her husband had been slighted when he did not receive the position in the community which she felt he richly deserved. And because of her feelings of hurt, she pushed him to express himself, to lead this rebellion, and the end was, of course, that the whole family and all their followers died out. It's very, we need, as we take each step of life, very often we need advice. But often we need advice from someone who's a little more objective than someone who's in the thick of this, who's emotionally involved. This may be an aside, but I'd just like to share this with you, again, with the idea of sharing. When a let's say a husband's in the workplace, and you know, not every day is a great day, and very often you've it's terrible, and not just the frustrations that normally come with the work, but a person is put down, a person is abused. There are situations where you have to just share it with someone. And the first person you naturally share is the person's your wife. Come home from, you want to share it with your wife. Very often she's the worst person to share it with. A, because she becomes emotionally involved, you know, like the wife of Korach. Second, even though the person doesn't realize this, there's the need for the, I mean, really it's for both partners, but very often the wife needs to have a husband that she feels is someone that's worthy of respect. She goes and keeps on hearing that this one kicked him around and that one kicked him around, and she, you know, maybe he's not all that he's touted to be. You know, maybe he's really not worthy of all the respect I've given him because he's subject to all this abuse in the workplace. Maybe they know something I don't. And what naturally, what the husband would feel would be, this is the place to share it and to get solace and comfort, can often have the opposite effect. And that's why it seems it's important, especially in areas outside of the home, for the husband to have other sources of advice, not just the wife. Because the wife, of course, is always the source of advice. But you need also someone who's going to be, you know, who's not so emotionally involved. You know, someone who can stand aside and say, you know, wait a minute here. You know, and they look objectively at this. And there is and this is what the Talmud deals with, a terrible problem where one naturally feels like this is the place to pour out your heart and to seek all your advice. But very often you need to hear objective advice. And the spouse is just too close to the situation. One would perhaps, again, maybe it's not a good analogy, but one could use a parallel from this. There's a verse that we use, Kerachem Ov Albonim, like the compassion a father has for children. You know, we ask the prayers, we ask God should have compassion upon us. And the question is asked, why say the compassion a father has for a child? Why not say that a mother has? Generally, a mother has much more compassion than the father. Why the father's compassion? And the answer they give is because the mother's too compassionate. You know, this is ill kind, you know, it's too... The father's not... It's just a little more objective. And very often when the kid is crying, you know, and it hurts him, I don't want to go to school, and the... Sometimes you need the father to get him so you better go to school or else. And the mother, you know, there's the mother is the heart of the marriage. She's the emotion of the marriage. She's the softness of the marriage. It's tempered with the husband's, we say, the head, which is less emotional, not always, but more rational. Together they form a perfect pair. But the heart is always not the best place to seek advice. So knowing the unique makeup of one's spouse is important, again, for the success of a marriage. Now again, the last page, G, stands for God. And here I would like to that's to reiterate a point that we've made before. We start off with M, about the mystic relationship, the spiritual relationship between a husband and a wife. What this passage of the Talmud says, and we'll read this together here, this is taken from Sota. Rabbi Akiva expounded, when husband and wife are worthy, the Shekhinah abides with them. When they are not worthy, fire consumes them. The Hebrew word for man is ish. Ish is made up of three letters: Aleph, Yud, and Shin. The Hebrew word for woman is Isha. Right? It's Aleph, Shin, He. They share with them two letters which are common, right? Aleph and Shin. Both the man has the word has the letters Aleph Shin. The woman has the letters Aleph Shin. What's the difference between them? The man is Aleph Yud Shin, has a Yud. The woman is Aleph Shin He, has a He. The letter Yud combines with the letter He to be one of God's names. The Yud, right, is one of God's names. Isha, man, woman, is really fire, is energy, is emotion with God. You take God away, all you have is just energy, which is all-consuming. Each one adds their unique area. The Yud, the He. The combination of the two makes the Shekhinah, the divine presence, rest in a Jewish home. One of the great casualties of the modern era is, we would say, the lack of Shekhinah, the lack of the divine presence in a home. We've relegated the divine presence to a big building, one of a few in a city, which we call the synagogue or a temple. We say, that's the place where God rests. And the home seems to be, the element of God seems to be missing. Even if one has a mezuzah, or one has some sefer, some book, or some... I mean, not every Jewish home has this as well. I was remember a few years ago, I was visiting someone. They're an intelligent person. And we were talking, and I asked them, you know, I was referring to a quote, and I'd like to see the original quote, and if he had a Bible. He looked and he looked. All he had was a New Testament. All he had was a combination. That's all he had. He had a big picture. He had a big statue of Buddha. You know, but he didn't. You know, needless to say, I mean that. I knew them when they were married, when they were divorced. It's hard to say the Shekhinah, the divine presence, was in that home. We often think of prayer as prayer is in a special building, again, a few of those buildings in every city, where one leaves one house and one goes to that building to pray. In actuality, the consensus of Jewish law is that both men and women are required to pray, and not necessarily depends on the situation, but not necessarily in a synagogue. And for most people, you pray at home. A home is a place, every home is a little shul. It isn't just God is out there. God is home. And I think we've paid for this change of the placement of God at a severe cost. Because if you looked at your home, everyone's home, as a synagogue, as a little shul, you act differently. You know, God's here. You don't put your tie around over here. You act differently. This is a place where the divine presence is here. You don't take liberties at abuse. To perhaps say something that hurts. If you know God's standing over here, He's here. I think that in creating, and there are very many reasons for this, but in creating great structures and great synagogues, in the process, what we've done is we've said, really, He doesn't belong at home. And really, God is at home. You don't really have to. There are many people that, because of distance,
You don't have to go to shul on Shabbos. There are many reasons to go. You know, there's positives. You're with a minyan, you're with a group. I mean, there are many positives. But it doesn't have to be. God's everywhere, and especially in your home. I'm not saying people shouldn't go to shul, you know, and I'm not saying they shouldn't go to the synagogue, but I don't think enough stress is placed about God in your home. It's a different home that you could feel free to pray to God. Every time you eat, you say thanks. You make a bracha. And when you finish eating, you say thanks. It's a sense that there's sanctity to this home. And it all fits into this picture that we've tried to create. That what we are really spiritual beings. You know, and really, that's where it should be, is home. Because if I and my wife are two parts of this spiritual combination, we should be close to God. You know, and that's, he should belongs in my house. And really, it's not just a coincidence that the yud is in the Hebrew word for man, ish, and the hey is in the Hebrew word isha for woman. God combines in the holy union. God combines in one's home. And the last E is for evolution. In Pirkei Avos, there's a great stress about making friends. In the early, in the beginning, it says, "Kne lecho chover," acquire for yourself a friend. What's the purpose of having a friend? I mean, we know we could give a whole list of reasons, of course. But one of the reasons that's given, and amazing, is that a friend is someone who could point out your faults in a way that you're not offended, in a way that you can improve. We spoke before about very often about the problems of a wife being too close to the situation. If a wife is too close, the person themselves for sure too close. And it's very hard for them to see one's own faults. I mean, you just don't see it. And one of the purposes of a friend, a true friend, who's really interested in the growth, the spiritual growth of their friend, is in a nice way, in a positive way, to nudge the person to onto the right path. I mean, that's what this toichocha, this rebuke, is part of the dynamics of friendship. If it's by two friends, it's most certainly by a husband and a wife. We've spoken about love, about growth, but there is a dynamic tension in a marriage as well. The story, the beautiful story, is told in the Talmud about one of the great sages of the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan. And he had a colleague, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. And when his colleague died, and this colleague was the one, after the lecture was given, the colleague was the one who made the comments on the lecture. It was like the rebuttal. It was the comments on the lecture. When Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish died, another colleague, Rabbi Elazar, took his place. And Rabbi Yochanan then, the next day, gave his lecture. Rabbi Elazar went and stated, gave a whole list of reasons why the lecture was correct. And as he said, it's because he brought proofs, it's right because on this count, on that count, the other count. And Rabbi Yochanan was besides himself. He says, when your predecessor, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, had the same seat, he used to challenge me. Every argument that I made, he made 24 arguments to the contrary. And I had to answer those arguments. And the give and take, says, through the give and take, a whole new dimensions of understanding came to light. He says, I don't need you to tell me I'm right. I know I'm right. I need you to tell me I'm wrong so I can defend myself. And through the interaction of the back and forth, everything will become clarified. Rabbi Yochanan was so distraught with the loss of his colleague that he eventually, it says that he became insane. I mean, he lost it from grief, and he eventually died. Because he felt the need of someone not just to tell him yes, but to challenge him as well. Part of the dynamics of a marriage is this challenge. Sometimes a challenge is non-productive. It's counterproductive. This is the classic where the person's always criticizing. This is a criticism that comes from love, not a criticism that comes from hatred. But it's this dynamic that sets a person on the right path. And this is why it's called the creation of the idea of a husband and a wife. It's called Ezer Kenegdo. It's a help opposite him. It's a help, but it's opposite. It doesn't always, they're not in tandem. They're not walking side by side. They're opposite each other. Everything is good, is fine. But if someone gets out of line, there's the Kenegdo. There's the voice of the loyal opposition. I don't want you to take this out of context, of course. The essence of the marriage, as we said before, is spiritual growth. It's true affection and care. But it shouldn't be mistaken for always saying yes. There has to be a time when you say no. And the positive tension of the side of the husband, the side of the wife, both well-meaning, both secure in the love they have for each other, creates, they say, this evolution and forms really what is the ultimate purpose of the marriage is, we say, the spiritual growth through life. At this point, I'll take a few questions. And then from then on, there's refreshment served, and we could, and privately I'll take questions. Okay.
Yes. Except about all these shidduchs and intermarriage. How have you looked on...
The question, which is a... the question was asked about how do we look at the shidduch of intermarriage, which is a... 30 years ago, the question probably wouldn't have been asked. Let me just explain this as shortly and with the greatest sensitivity because as I can, which really highlights what really comes to a really is the difference, I guess, from the Talmud's view of a Jew and a non-Jew. Every human being is created in God's image. Tzelem Elokim. The Jews have a unique relationship with God. They are the Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kodosh. They are the kingdom of priests, the holy nation. There's a special covenant between God and the Jews. This is really what the whole Torah is all about, is this covenant. So a Jew is basically we look at is really a priest. A Jewish woman is a priestess. The Jewish marriage then, following this, is a priest and a priestess marrying, living this priestly existence. Really, this is the existence which is outlined in the Torah. When you have an intermarriage, you'll have one perhaps trying to live in the best possible way as the priest. The other one has never made such a commitment. So you don't have that interaction of what we call the Jewish marriage. It's not a priestly marriage. It's really a non-Jewish marriage that one of the partners is a Jew. But the expectations of that marriage is not the priesthood, so to say, which is the mark of the Jew. So besides any other factor, in other words, the question of the children, besides any other factor, in terms of the dynamics of the marriage itself, it won't be a Jewish marriage, as a classical Jewish marriage, and as a marriage which is predicated on that spiritual growth which is unique to the B'nai B'rith, in other words, the people of the covenant, because their level of spirituality is on a different level because of their commitment to be priests. And I just, you know, in a short period, I hope, you know, this is only one part of the, you know, of the whole issue, but vis-a-vis the marriage, I think it's... Yes?
You said at the beginning the 40 days before someone's born?
Yeah, no, before the formation of the embryo. It's from conception, you know, when the ovum and the sperm meet. It takes 40 days until we see the outline of a human being.
Before someone born, it says in heaven that going to be married with...
Right, because the soul is in heaven too. And the person's not on earth, but the soul is in heaven.
So intermarriage are made in heaven. I mean, is it possible that the angel making intermarriage between a Jew and non-Jew?
I don't believe so. I mean, you know, I can't say I wasn't there, but I have no memory of it. my understanding is that wouldn't be so. And because that isn't really the whole idea of a marriage is, it's really one spiritual growth. You know, it's the, you know, so I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, so what does it mean that this, I mean, this marriage, for what you say, are made, has made somewhere. So,
wait. So it would be akin, perhaps, as we said, the question about where does this fit in. We said there are two levels of marriages. We call the zivug rishon, the initial one, and the zivug sheni, the secondary one. This goes into the secondary one, not the initial one.
When a person actually, even before we even before we born and much before that, the marriage has been already settled, because
very often
if someone born and his wife has born 10 years after him, so it's already said that they are going to be together.
Right, that's what the Talmud is saying. At least that's the Zivug Rishon. In other words, that's the initial ideal marriage.
Even before...
Right, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's what the Talmud is saying. Really, that's Jewish tradition. Yeah. Okay, why don't we break for refreshments here?
One moment. First of all, next time I come home, Rabbi Aaron, tonight, I'll be very careful with my actions. Also, how is it, after all these years I've been attending your lessons, your lectures, and each time I leave a lecture, I always think that I learn so much, and I walk away knowing I know less. So.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.